This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Sunset Lake CBD at sunsetlakecbd.com. You have heard me talk about this company. Farm. They started out as a dairy farm. They were providing dairy for Ben and Jerry's up in Vermont. And in 2018, they decided to diversify. They started to grow hemp and make these amazing CBD products. I was a CBD skeptic. I had had some experience trying like tinctures before and et cetera, et cetera. These guys are fans of the show. They wanted to advertise. I tried out their products. We all did to a certain extent. Everybody loved them. They are the hemp that they grow is pesticide free. They practice regenerative farming practices that they work with the University of Vermont to do. They are majority employee owned, $15 minimum wage. So they got great business practices, but their products are amazing. We got, I use their tinctures and their salves constantly, literally last night. Salves I use now, it's supposed to be for muscle relaxant. I'm using it for like sometimes I get little patches of dry skin or eczema. But there are gummies, CBD gummies. They have great CBD infused coffee, Kenyan coffee. I think it's a limited release that they're doing now. And they have pre-rolls and they have flowers, buds, and stuff like that. We got this email last Friday from listener Bridget. I just smoked a Keef blunt per Matt's recommendation, This ish isn't effing around. I don't know why I can't say those swear words, but I'm not going to. And then they went on to say that the fun half was really funny. But the point is that smoking CBD is a weird experience. You get that sort of like relaxed buzz, but you don't get the mental high. Matt, talk about your favorite smalls.
Yeah, smalls, for people who don't know, they're these sort of sort of taken off the stem buds that you can put right in your grinder. Pretty useful product line, I found out.
If you deal with like any type of muscle aches or stuff like that, I highly recommend the salve.
Yeah, you might need it for pain.
I know. I just broke my toe. Not just the second, but last night. It has arnica. It has CBD. It is all of the products are really great. You're gonna love it. Left is best. Fans of the show, they want to use the coupon code Left is best. One word, Left is best. You get 20% off. Go check it out right now. SunsetLakeCBD.com. Great products. Great company. Also, we've got policing problem in America, no doubt about it. Our sponsor this week, Future Hindsight, has a great interview with former Seattle police chief turned police reform advocate Norm Stamper. They discuss how our police forces got to this point and how we can use the pandemic to jumpstart meaningful, lasting reform. Listen to Future Hindsight wherever you get your podcasts or futurehindsight.com. Listen to Future Hindsight wherever you get your podcasts or futurehindsight.com. On with the show.
Friday. That means Monday is Casual Monday. Tuesday, Casual Tuesday. Wednesday, Casual Hump Day. Thursday, Casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, Casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, December 11th, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the 5-time award-winning Majority Report. You're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, staff writer with the New Republic, co-host of the podcast, The Politics of Everything, Alex Perrine will be joining us to look back on this week, to look forward to next week. Then later, in the fun half of the program, Matthew Film Guy will be here to talk about, I think, his film and what film we should watch this weekend. Meanwhile, the FDA Advisory Board recommends a Pfizer vaccine emergency approval. Shots could start with official FDA approval as early as Monday. Meanwhile, Mitch McConnell continues to block bipartisan compromise on the COVID economic relief. And 106 House Republicans sign on to the Texas Attorney General's election suit versus other swing states. And completely coincidentally, I'm sure, the ongoing federal investigation into that very same Texas Attorney General happens to be heating up these days. Like something you would be wanting to look for a pardon for, maybe. The director of the CDC allegedly ordered the destruction of an email showing the Trump administration looking to change the scientific COVID findings the CDC had established. Meanwhile, Brandon Bernard killed last night, the ninth federal execution since Trump lifted the moratorium in July. Wilbur Ross has been subpoenaed by House Democrats for census data delay accounting. And UFC mixed martial arts fighters been found to allowed to sue as a class over the antitrust violations of the UFC. Meanwhile, a federal judge allows continued blocking of abortion restrictions in light of the pandemic. And the Supreme Court allows Muslim would-be informants to sue FBI, essentially for harassment. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us on Casual Friday. Emma Viglin is here. She can attest to the fact that I am wearing a soft-collared shirt. Emma, would you please attest to that fact now?
I will attest to it, and I think anybody with eyes can attest to it. The collar is especially soft today, so that means it's Friday.
Right. That's exactly right. It's
casual
the
only
Friday.
Way I can tell. Yeah.
That's right. It's the only way. And so I we take this opportunity to dress casually around the office, although we're not, you know, we're not around the office per se during COVID, but still maintaining some of the normalcy, which we hope to return to, 3 to 6 months from now. It would have been much higher, of course, had the Trump administration actually purchased enough vaccinations, but that won't happen. If the FDA does approve this COVID vaccine by
that
Pfizer,
that would have been too competent for their taste.
Way too competent. If they do end up approving it, the vaccinations will start on Monday. They will start obviously with healthcare workers and then go to nursing homes. Healthcare workers obviously most exposed to it. It's you want to keep these people as healthy as possible, obviously, because we are about to enter into what the director of the CDC described as probably the darkest time in the public health history of the United States. We had nearly 3,000 people die yesterday, 2,923 directly attributed to coronavirus. We had 223,000 infections yesterday. Again, if you want to know how many people are going to be dying, anywhere from 16 to 21 days from now, take that figure, multiply it times 1.4, then multiply it times 1.4%, and then multiply it times 1.8%, and you will get a fairly good estimation of how many people are going to die two to two and a half weeks from now.
It's a 9/11 every day, as they've been saying. I mean, that should be sobering. COVID is now the leading cause of death, passing heart disease in the United States. I don't know what else, what statistics are going to wake people out of this denial that they've been in, or the fatigue due to the protocols. But I people seem to be immune to all figures at this point. No pun intended.
Yeah, and I, you know, and some of it I would imagine is like, this is, you know, a normal human response. I mean, you know, I think after this, we're going to have epidemiologists and sociologists really determine that that the second wave of these pandemics is largely less about biology and more about sort of sociology. But there is no doubt that the momentum driven by the Trump administration of denial is playing a big part in this, without a doubt.
100%.
And, you know, I'm just, I have a million tabs open on my computer, and I was, you know, every now and then I try and go through and close some of them. And I came across one that was open from September 17th, 2020.
This would bug me so much if I were, and, you know, I'm a tab closer.
And well, I'm glad. This is part of the reason why I do this, I think. Mark Noller, former CBS White House correspondent, tweeted out on that day, Chief of Staff Mark Meadows says White House aiming to have 100 million doses of coronavirus vaccine ready to go by end of October. Says goal is to make the most vulnerable and highest risk people are vaccinated in that first group. Says up to 300 million doses would be ready in January. Well, it's stunning to, I mean, obviously the guy was just lying, because he knew at that point they had not reserved that amount.
Right.
They knew by September, sort of, I think, had at least a sense of which vaccinations were showing some measure of success. And
they're now saying 20 million doses by end of year, and that's from the administration. So don't even take that at face value.
Indeed. And then if we're lucky, we may get another 100 million doses through the first 6 months of 2021. That is in terms of the Pfizer vaccination. I would imagine soon we're going to be getting close to a decision on the Moderna vaccination. We will see. But turning our attention to the other sort of element of COVID, aside from the actual death, from the infections and from, but to the implications of trying to protect ourselves. Another reason why we have not been able to protect ourselves in the way that we should is because there has been an abject failure by our government to encourage protecting ourselves in a material way. And by that, I mean, we have not had any form of COVID relief economically from the federal government. Essentially, nothing's passed since April, and much of it is running out, if it hasn't already. And there's an attempt to do so in the Senate. Mitch McConnell is standing in the way of, he's standing in the way of a vote, frankly, on a compromise solution. It's unclear to me how many Republicans have signed on, but we know at least a couple have.
Right.
To this compromise. And yeah, it's a compromise bill. It's not, you know, this is not something that Emma, you and I would choose, but it is something to get something out the door. Mitch McConnell standing in the way of it. Meanwhile, Bernie Sanders is trying to apply pressure as well. I mean, this is the way when you have Mitch McConnell on one side shutting everything down, very important to have people who are trying to pull the bill in a more humane fashion. Here is Bernie Sanders yesterday. Today is the marks the 1 year anniversary of his, I think it was what, a 10-hour filibuster on the sunsetting of the Bush tax cuts and allowing that to happen. But it, and sadly, it did not. There was not enough that were repealed there or allowed to sunset. But nevertheless, here is Bernie Sanders explaining on Thursday why Americans need a $1,200 stimulus check.
The American people need help, and they need help now. In fact, there has never been a time in the modern history of this country when the American people were in more economic desperation and a time when people needed help. And if a government means anything, it means that we cannot turn our backs on tens of millions of families who today are suffering. So, Madam President, we have got to make sure that every working family in America, every working individual in America, receives at least $1,200 in direct payment. That is what we have got to do. We cannot continue the status quo of simply coming in here to work and then going home and going back on the for our holiday. So, Madam President, I am going to do everything that I can to insist that we make sure that every working person in this country gets a $1,200 direct payment. And we're not going to go home until that happens. Madam President, thank you very much.
So there's Bernie Sanders arguing essentially that we need that $1,200 stimulus. That was part of also in the HEROES Act, if I remember correctly. It was obviously it was in the CARES Act, but it's also in the HEROES Act that the House Democrats passed over the summer.
And McConnell sat on for months and months.
And McConnell and sat months, on for months. And then I think in the $2 trillion bill that Pelosi, or at least I guess proposal that Pelosi had in negotiations with Steve Mnuchin in the run up to the election, I believe that $1,200 was included in there as well. And so here is, this is a clip from Wednesday. And when you talk about the forces, I mean, here is the problem, right? The problem is that the stock market is up. People who can work from home, people who have jobs like ours, we're working, we're okay, right? I mean, we're not necessarily. However, the flip side of that is that you have a huge spike in shoplifting of food. You have cars lined up from Massachusetts to Texas and to LA, lined up to get food because people are unable to feed themselves and their families.
1.4 million Americans filing for unemployment last week, over 19 million officially on unemployment. It's going to be higher because not everybody who's unemployed is filing for unemployment insurance.
And they can pass a $300 federal bonus on your unemployment insurance. But if your unemployment insurance runs out December 26th, like it's going to for 12 million Americans, that's not going to get you anything. And no. So the problem is that there is a huge cohort of people in this country who are just fine. And they are, in many respects, controlling the narrative. And you see people like Bernie Sanders and Katie Porter going out there and saying, this isn't stimulus. This isn't to get the economy going. This is emergency relief for people so they can actually like function and live their lives and eat or stay in their homes, et cetera, et cetera.
But it also would stimulate. I mean, the reason that Josh Hawley, who wants to run for president, the Republican senator, is working on this with Bernie Sanders is because not only would it provide relief for people, it would stimulate the economy. And also it's wildly popular. We saw Trump got a bit of a boost from this. So Hawley wants to run in 2024. He signed on with Bernie here. And yet, because the Democrats don't have any sense of politics, they could have neutered the Hawley claiming of this idea in the Senate, right? That the Republicans, one Republican, one Democrat signing on to this, if the Democrats in unison said stimulus checks, but they don't want to do it. They want to keep it as vague as possible so Biden can claim victory regardless of what's in the bill.
Right, right. I think that's a big element as well. But yes, I agree. It will stimulate the economy. But the primary issue right now is really just getting people relief. But yes, of course, more money in the economy is definitely going to help. Here is an exchange from Wednesday, just to give you a sense of how much that impulse to not provide too much for people, because what if you overshoot and provide too much? How that plays out. This is an exchange between Stephanie Ruhle from MSNBC and Bernie Sanders. Let's play this clip.
Of the United States Democratic Senate is on board. The question now is whether or not Mitch McConnell is going to turn his back, as your report just indicated, on the incredible suffering that the American people, the working people, are now experiencing. Unemployment high. We have a record level of hunger in America. Millions of people are facing evictions. This is an emergency. Congress has got to respond aggressively to help working families. You know, Stephanie, I always get a kick. Here in Washington, when we go to war, there's endless amounts of money. Tax breaks for billionaires, endless amounts of money. Corporate welfare, endless amounts of money. When children are going hungry in America today, suddenly we don't have enough money. That's crap. That's wrong. And if we have got to stay here throughout Christmas, which is the last thing in the world that I would want to do, we are going to stay here because we are going to make sure that struggling working families in this country get the help they desperately need.
Senator, I'm not agreeing with you fundamentally, but I want to talk to you practically. You've been the lead sponsor of 422 bills during your 30 years in Congress. But only seven of them have become
positive
law.
One second.
Given
positive
that
one
record
second.
And how.
Pause for one second. I think she meant to say, I'm agreeing with you fundamentally.
Right.
Not, I'm not going to agree with you fundamentally. But let's go back. And I should also tell you that, like, you know, to have a graphic up for this, it didn't matter what Bernie Sanders was going to say here. Mm-hmm. And this is pretty stunning. Go back.
The help they desperately need.
Senator, I'm not agreeing with you fundamentally, but I want to talk to you practically. You've been the lead sponsor of 422 bills during your 30 years in Congress, but only seven of them have become law. Given that record and how dire things are, as you just laid out, do you need to find another lane or take a different approach here?
I don't think that's the issue, Stephanie. I mean, you can ask me how many other senators have passed significant legislation in recent years. Question is, you could name post offices and so forth and so on. Some of the legislation that I've worked on, the Veterans Bill, for example, has been very significant in passing. But the issue right now is the United States Congress going to stand up for working people or not? And I am doing my best to rally not only Democrats, but Republicans as well. Now, as you may know, the proposal that came out of the White House just
all right. Yeah. I mean, we don't need to see his response.
Yeah.
To this.
I mean, he kept his cool.
Right. But the idea, and let's just put this up. I mean, because I've never seen anything quite like that before, where you have senators staking out positions. Obviously, I mean, I don't know if it's, I mean, I don't know how to even measure what he's proposing as being impractical. The entire Democratic caucus has been proposing this. He is demanding that it happens. It certainly is going to put pressure on Mitch McConnell, who is killing anything that existed. I mean, as a practical matter, I wouldn't be terribly surprised if he wasn't doing this with the encouragement of the Democratic leadership, so that they can sit at the table and say, like, hey, we've got someone on our left flank too. I mean, this is just, it's bizarre, but just as a practical matter, we prepared for this clip. That's why we have this graphic ready. Put it up. Sanders with the primary responsibility. Those bills. Very few bills are ever enacted, anyways. Here the list of those seven ones. Like you said, that the VA one, probably the biggest one. Let's move on. Let's see what the next graphic we have here. Here is the here's Nancy Pelosi's record. Seven bills that were enacted. Now, the as a primary sponsor. I mean, look, this is it's a silly thing to even bring up, never mind in this context. And it shows you if there is that level, if there is this, I mean, I don't even know in what context this is impractical. Is it impractical because the Republicans won't do it? Or is it impractical because we don't have the money for it?
Well, she has a he has a Republican signing on with him. This is the exact kind of bipartisanship. Josh Hawley is doing this with Bernie Sanders that usually cable anchors would be praising. But because it's Bernie Sanders, they have that graphic teed up there. And by the way, Stephanie is the anchor who talked about how she was offended by Biden's comment saying that this is Scranton versus Park Avenue, right? Saying, why aren't the wealthy represented in the Biden administration? So I don't think she actually fundamentally agrees with Bernie Sanders' proposal here. I think this is kind of her perspective. So let's be open about that when talking about the framing here. And also, Bernie Sanders has been known throughout his career. What was it? The Rolling Stone article about how he's the amendment king. Bernie has in the past tweaked massive parts of legislation to put little things in there to help working people. And yet that never gets the credit. And exactly there, right? Like, it's just, it's this circular conversation because they already, Bernie Sanders was already disliked. So look, he never gets anything done. And I mean, here we go.
It's not even so much about, I mean, I think, I think you know, to frame it in the point of like Bernie Sanders is disliked, I think really what is even more relevant, and this is maybe what you're getting at, is that his issue set is disdained.
Right.
It's not that, you know, maybe they dislike him personally or whatever. Who knows? Who cares? But the bottom line is that he's out there insisting on this demand, which, of course, is not, it's not anything new. I mean, we have other we've had Democrats propose this throughout the entire crisis. It is clearly needed by the American public. The idea that it's impractical, I just I still can't even wrap my head around it. It's like the idea that he is in somehow inhibiting a deal getting made right now is absurd. Everyone knows it is Mitch McConnell who is stopping this deal. And to the extent that Mitch McConnell can be forced to the table, having someone to the left of where the negotiations are certainly helps it. That is actually one of the most practical things you could possibly be doing.
Absolutely. So, but it's all about passing legislation irrespective of what's in it. I mean, and that's like the kind of culture that really sucks in media.
But even if that's your assessment, that's what you want to do, having Bernie Sanders doing that at this time makes it much more likely that you're going to get that compromise,
especially
bill.
When he's teamed up with a Republican.
Of course, I think what it is a it is part of what we've seen, and this has happened from different parts of the Democratic establishment, not necessarily the lawmakers, but like, you know, former economic advisors, guys like Jason Furman and whatnot. What you really don't want to do is you don't want to overshoot and give too much to people. I mean, to the extent that, like, you know, if we're going to err, we'll err on the side of being skimpy, because that suffering will be localized into, or I should say, will be contained within people in the lower 50% of the income distribution. And so that's not going to affect the economy.
Right.
I mean, that's basically the story that we're being told here. And that is the story that comes out of finance. But hopefully it will, you know, Sanders will draw more attention to this and create more pressure on Mitch McConnell, who's got to worry about what's happening in Georgia. If you've got a Democrat out there saying, hey, Mitch McConnell is in the way of this, why don't we have those $1,200 checks? Look to Mitch McConnell right now. Then maybe things will go the right way in Georgia. We will get to Alex Preen in just a moment. But first, I should tell you this, and this has been a big help for me ever since I've found it, because my daughter loves to do a lot of online shopping. So you're
Same
making
girl.
Your list for the holidays. And then imagine this, Emma, somebody comes in and says, here's a little bit of extra cash.
Nice.
For your holidays. Well, that's what Honey is doing. Is this the same Honey that automatically searches for promo codes? Yes, it is. With Honey, you can also make a list of all the holiday gifts you want from certain stores, and Honey will email you when the price drops on anything on your list. This is a new feature. All you got to do is add Honey to your computer, create a free account, throw some holiday gifts on your drop list, And also, when you do that, you are entered to win $1 million worth of gifts. Honey's going to randomly select winners and give them the money to help buy something on their list. Not up to 1 million, but they're going to help pay people to buy stuff on their list. So they're going to spend, I guess, $1 million. No purchase is necessary. You need a PayPal account to redeem the prize. Only valid in the U.S. Giveaway ends in December 21, 2020. So you get about 10 days to do this. There's going to be a lot of Legos on my list. I'm not going to lie. I have discovered that Legos are both make my son happy and also keep him busy. And then my daughter gets a lot of like clothes. She basically sends me a list every year now where it's like, I want this blouse. I want these boots. And she's going to get them. So folks, check it out. Honey will save you money every time you purchase something or can, if there's any coupon codes out there. And like I say, they will let you know when the prices on the things you want to buy drop. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/majority. That's joinhoney.com/majority. So, Michael would appreciate this. Michael, for a long time, tried to get me into meditation. And, I'm not saying that I'm there yet.
Yeah.
But here's been my big hesitance, right? Is that like the idea of sitting down and doing nothing for any period of time, I can't do that.
It's hard. It's hard.
I've got too much to do.
Yeah.
I just don't have the time to do that. Like I say, like I watch television rarely, only like when my toe is broken. But Headspace. Headspace is provides you a daily dose of mindfulness in the form of guided meditation in an easy to use app. But here's the thing that I really like about Headspace. And I don't know. I mean, other people can do this, but they have like walking meditation. So you see where I'm going with this? I walk to work. I can do my meditation. I walk home. I can do my meditation. Headspace is backed by 25 published studies on its benefits. They get 600,000 five-star reviews. They have over 60 million downloads. Whatever the situation, Headspace can really help you feel better. Need some help falling asleep? Are you overwhelmed? I just described, I think, 95% of the people who will ever hear my voice right now. Headspace has wind-down sessions and three-minute SOS meditations for you. They even have meditations for kids. Works for you on your schedule, anytime, anywhere. And like I say, for me, it's on my walk. And they sort of like layers it in, right? Because I'm not good at this. I have an agenda constantly, no matter where.
You have your training wheels on for meditation.
I have my meditation training wheels on. And it's like, you know, it's interesting. I'm walking down and it doesn't matter really where you are walking. It works everywhere. It just gets you to be sort of more conscious of the present, essentially, I think is really what the best way for me to describe it. Check it out. You deserve to feel happier, and Headspace is meditation made simple. Go to headspace.com/majority. That's headspace.com/majority for a free 1 month trial with access to Headspace full library of meditations for every situation. This is the best deal they got offered right now. Head to headspace.com/majority. today. And lastly, it's easy to get caught up in the holiday craze these days. It's also difficult, obviously, to get medical care. When do you have time to see a doctor? When do you feel comfortable? It seems impossible. Well, thanks to PlushCare, you can see a doctor right away. And whether you're at home, whether you're at the office, whether you're on the go, it doesn't matter. PlushCare provides virtual doctor appointments through your smartphone or computer. All you got to do is you pick a time that works for you. You book an appointment right online. With PlushCare, you can be diagnosed, treated, and even have a prescription sent to your pharmacy within just moments. PlushCare accepts most major insurance carriers. It's available in all 50 states. The doctors are here to help by discussing treatment options and providing prescriptions as needed. If you're having difficulty managing your emotions, PlushCare doctors are also available to help. You can schedule an appointment today to discuss your treatment options. PlushCare makes it easier than ever to take care of yourself inside and out. You can start your membership today. Go to plushcare.com/majority. You'll start your free 30-day trial. You have 30 days to try it out. That's plushcare, plushcare.com/majority for a 30-day free trial, plushcare.com/majority. All right, let's welcome to the program Alex Perrine. Thank you for your patience, Alex. Much appreciated. Alex Perrine, of course, the staff writer for The New Republic. Not the staff writer, but I mean, in my mind, you are the staff writer.
The number one staff writer.
You're a staff writer, but you're the staff writer. And also the co-host of The Politics of Everything. Alex Perrine, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sam.
You have really upgraded what you got going on there now.
Love your art. I was just thinking that.
Thank you. Well, yeah, only the best for you. I've colonized the living room, which I've seized from my wife. This is usually where she works, and but just for you, I decided I would take the nicer spot today.
All right. Well, fantastic. You look great. Much appreciated. You know, I really wanted to speak to you this week because There's a theme running through the week on some level. Of course, you know, we obviously have devastating COVID numbers. We have the Attorney General from Texas trying to get a case at the Supreme Court. I don't think it's going to go anywhere, but 106 Republicans have signed on to it in the House, filing an amicus brief. We will talk about that, but I want to talk about a piece that you wrote a couple of days ago. This is a story we just touched on briefly, but it's been something that I think is, like, you know, very problematic that that is part of a larger whole in terms of our elites in this country, right? I mean, we have Rudy Giuliani going to the hospital saying that you know, he's a celebrity, so he gets special treatment, and he had COVID. But you wrote a piece on big law, elite law, essentially. And this has been, you know, one of those things that's sort of hard to peg a story to.
Right.
Because you see the impact of this through, like, tweets and whatnot. But talk about sort of like the backdrop a little bit. I mean, in many ways, this story is indicative of a larger problem.
Yeah, sure. So I'm sure most of your audience saw at least something about the story about a Supreme Court hearing arguments in this case where former child slaves, people who were basically enslaved as children and forced to work for no money on cocoa plantations, were suing Nestle and Cargill for aiding and abetting their enslavement. And
these plantations are located in, was it Sierra Leone? Where
I think I know the people were from Mali, but they were kidnapped from Mali and then sent elsewhere. But so they're not American. So that's right. So they're trying to sue these corporations that profited from their enslavement. The Nestle and Cargill's defense basically relied on going to Supreme Court, arguing that these people didn't have the standing to sue them, essentially. And arguing the case was Neil Katyal, who is one of the most decorated attorneys in the country. He's won, like, Lawyer of the Year awards, basically. And he's been in and out of Democratic administrations, Obama and the Clinton administration in the Justice Department. And he was Obama's acting Solicitor General for a time before he returned to private practice.
Solicitor General is essentially your attorney who represents the government, often at the Supreme Court. I mean,
yeah.
But go ahead.
Yeah. And you know, he's very much a sort of embodiment of that element of the Democratic establishment. I know we always talk about how there are different Democratic parties, but he's a Washington fixture. He has worked at the highest levels of government, and he's been a solid and consistent Democrat his whole career. And, you know, this last few years, he's made a living being a sort of big anti-Trump pundit. You know, he writes op-eds, he goes on TV, And he's really stoked that sort of resistance thing to become a hero among many people who really don't like Donald Trump. So anyway, he goes before the Supreme Court and basically makes this insane case for corporate immunity, basically saying that no foreigners could sue any corporation for any reason. It got to the point where justices were asking him, so if an individual enslaved another individual, could you sue that individual? And he was like, yeah, sure. And they're like, if four people conspired to enslave someone, could that person sue them? And he's like, yeah, sure. If those four people formed a corporation that enslaved someone, then could you sue? And Catchall was like, no, at that point, no, you can't. So, you know, they were arguing according to this, you know, fairly arcane law, but that law, you know, if you actually read it, basically is supposed to give people the right to sue American corporations when they are harmed by them. But anyway, I wrote a piece basically saying that, you know, it's very bad that incredibly highly decorated Democratic attorneys are making careers out of working for giant law firms that argue cases like this. And I think it's political. I think it's ideological. And I think attorneys have a very ideological understanding of their job that allows them to forgive their own for making heinous, morally heinous arguments. And the point of my piece was that lawyers have taken this right to an attorney that is written into the Bill of Rights for when people are being prosecuted for crimes by the government, for individuals being prosecuted for crimes by the government, have a right to an attorney. That's written in the Bill of Rights. And basically, over the course of 100 years or so, they turned that into, we have a right to take any client we want and make any argument on their behalf and then not face criticism for it. Because, you know, when left-wing and liberal people were saying Neil Katyal's arguments are morally repulsive, there were all these attorney types would be like, no, you don't understand how the law works. He has to be an advocate for his client. He has to make the best argument possible for his client. And, you know, I don't actually think like a code that says he has to take big checks from Nestle and Cargill to argue that it shouldn't be possible for anyone to sue them. I don't actually think that's really a code worth defending.
Yeah, I actually had this debate with people about Harvey Weinstein and the moral reprehensibility of representing him in court or somebody like that. And
but that's different.
I know it's different, right.
That is different because we are talking about there is a fundamental difference between a situation where the government is pressing criminal charges against somebody and everybody has a right to representation. And that is fundamental to our operations as a democratic society, where we do not have so much authority placed in in the government. And you know, and I say this, I was raised by lawyers. I went to law school for a period of time. The legal institution is highly problematic in this area. And I would expand it a little bit too, because this is part of the same, I think, problem where we hear lawyers when someone is brought up for Supreme Court justice or when someone is floated for AG, we hear from all these lawyers who are not left, but liberal avatars.
Mm.
Of the left or of the Democratic Party come out and say, hey, I can tell you this lawyer is a straight shooter. Or, right. I mean, we saw this. I mean, going back to like when Michael Mukasey was appointed, he's not going to be like the Bushies. Yeah. or when Bill Barr was appointed, when Amy Coney Barrett, Brett Kavanaugh, there was always, you have some legal professors who do this, who have some bona fides on the liberal left, and they do this because they want to make sure that they have a pipeline to the court for clerks.
Yep.
But then you also have other lawyers who do this because they are part of this sort of cohort of legal elite where, you know, Bill Barr, reasonable guy, takes the law very seriously.
Right.
And I mean, this is, I just want you to focus on for a moment, Alex, how this is, you know, the sort of, this isn't just a question of like, hey, this is morally repugnant. You shouldn't do that. There is a broader message being communicated that about corporations and right. about the role of these lawyers in our society that I think is highly problematic and causing problems. I mean,
right.
I mean,
I read for this piece, I read a little bit of legal history and you can see how vital lawyers have been to the project of basically the expansion of corporate power over the last century. Part of their code, and part of what they're taught in law school is to profess independence. That's part of, you know, sort of lawyerly professionalism, to say you're independent. But they have been, you know, when you look at the history of big tobacco, it was highly paid attorneys that were devising these arguments that tobacco companies used to mislead the public for decades. You know, and that was considered part of their work. And in more recently, people like Neil Katyal have been essential to the project of making it more difficult to sue a large corporation if you're an employer or a consumer or a person enslaved by a corporation. It's an actual project that these people are carrying out for ideological reasons. And then because I think that they also like happen to be professional Democrats, they don't expect people to, or they don't like it. They bristle when you actually say like you're the politics you are doing like right now is not you are doing politics at work in addition to when you go serve in the government. Like what you have decided to do for a living is a political project as much as when you take pro bono cases or as much as when you serve in the Justice Department.
And their response to that critique is that you're being political. I'm actually just adhering to a really, I mean, they honestly, there is a quality that they think that they're priests.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. I'm inclined to sort of like, you know, I certainly by the way that I was raised, I'm inclined to sort of to perceive the legal profession in that way to some degree, but there is abuse that is taking place. I mean, here's the thing. How is John Yoo, a professor at one of the most prestigious schools in the country?
Yeah.
Just remind people who John Yoo was.
John Yoo was the author of the Justification for Torture in the Bush administration and basically believes in a completely insane idea of executive power that would shield any president from sort of any limits to what he could authorize or what they could authorize.
And the problem here is that there is to maintain the code that says it is irrelevant what you're arguing in court in a civil case.
Yeah.
As long as you're doing your best.
Right.
As long as you're a qualified lawyer and you're being competent, the content of what you're arguing is irrelevant. I mean, it is very easy to see how defending people against that criticism leads to John Yoo getting made to be a professor at a top.
Yeah, it is. It's definitely this thing that I think is sort of ingrained in law students where it's like, don't judge the content of the argument or the result of the opinion, but judge like how well it was justified. Right. And like that leads you to defending some really like awful things and including being I don't agree with Bill Barr, but he's got like novel arguments for his insane position about executive immunity, you know?
I guess I'm also very sensitive to this because this is such a knee-jerk reaction on behalf of lawyers.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to sort of divorce my...
I've had this exact... conversation with my own parents too, so we're both lawyers.
the like I say, my father's an attorney. His father was an attorney. His uncles were attorneys. My great uncles were attorneys. My cousins were attorneys. Our attorneys, you know, a small town or a small city, second biggest city in New England, but nevertheless, and they saw I remember as a child, one of the few things I remember from my childhood was it was like somebody died in our family when lawyers were allowed to advertise.
Oh.
There was a sense that this is the, and it's funny, I've actually had this conversation. I'll put that aside, but Fran Lebowitz actually cited that one time that we spoke as being like the end of everything at that point, in terms of like the diminution of what it meant to be a professional when lawyers started to advertise. But that is how sacrosanct the law was held in esteem. I will have a conversation with my father where my father's like, well, I may not agree with Amy Coney Barrett, but she's a qualified lawyer. Well, what makes her qualified to be a Supreme Court justice if she withheld disclosures on her Senate interview, like multiple disclosures that were clearly not a mistake, but she didn't want people to know that she signed on to an abortion ad.
Well, it's also just this fetishization of legal intellect above all that that has nothing to do with the morality of the cases. And there's this cognitive dissonance that goes down, especially, you know, what you were talking about, Alex and Sam, about it being intertwined with the Democratic establishment too, where they divorce the content of what they're arguing from the consequences of it. So,
right.
And this is go ahead.
I think it's funny that you mentioned the thing about it, you know, once lawyers could advertise, like that was a diminution of the profession. Because I actually think there's this really funny thing with how law is understood among elite attorneys in the U.S. that you can sort of trace. Basically starting in the 60s and 70s and then gaining steam throughout the 80s, like the creation of the trial lawyer as a villain. And then like on the one hand, like the trial lawyer became a villain, and then like the hero becomes the white shoe firm corporate attorney.
Without a doubt.
And then somehow those become the highest level of elite law are these people who just defend corporations for a living. And then the people who advocate for normal people and try to get things to trial are considered like the shysters
against corporations. Absolutely.
Yeah.
That was
of Aaron Brockovich, but yeah.
Well, but no, but that is exactly what was imposed upon me as a, you know, and it's not like there's major corporations necessarily that my family, but it is the bastardization of that legal precept.
Yeah.
And frankly, you know, my work on Ring of Fire Radio and going to the tort conferences are when I started to realize, like, if I had known this was an option, you know, that was there's a lot of people there who are there to make money, but there's also a lot of people who are just like, you can't believe the malfeasance that goes on in these corporate C-suites. You just can't believe it.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right. There has been a reconstruction of like, what is the purpose of the law? What is, you know, and what constitutes good legal practice, bad legal practice. It's interesting now because this is becoming, you know, and Matt Stoller has written quite a bit about sort of big law. And this has been an area that has been unexamined. And in many respects, like, that's what's so interesting about this story. It's the first time that there has been an opportunity for people to address this sort of like simmering thing that you would occasionally see, like, you know, Atreos write a blog post about it that, you know, or a snarky tweet that, and I can't help but think about the interview that we did with Brian Fallon earlier this year in his organization, Demand Justice. He was a former Obama official who realized that they really messed up when it came to what they did in terms of judges and their failures. And his organization was determined to try and make sure that there are no corporate attorneys who are appointed federal judges going forward under this Biden administration. There are so many. It is chock full of corporate, former corporate attorneys. Yeah. We need to have diversity in the legal profession because it also signals to people deciding which part of the legal profession I'm going to enter into.
Yeah.
If there is some type of career trajectory that is raised up and is, you know, get some benefits within the context of society.
Right. And, you know, I heard from a few people who went to law school that and have read myself stories that the really top tier schools, like they take all of these kids who want to go into the law to make a positive difference. And they basically like tell them, no, you like the positive difference you make will be by being a great lawyer at one of these big firms.
Yes.
Like that. And so, and it's like, it's, you know, it's neoliberalism, but it's telling them like, oh, no, you can divorce your sort of personal politics from the work. And like the important thing to do will just be to be a really great, great lawyer.
Well, we saw this
on the side.
We're seeing this now, like with the justification really last night of Amy Coney Barrett and other conservative justices' decision to execute Brandon Bernard and allow that to go through. Like, oh, we're divorcing the morality of it from it. We're just looking at the letter of the law, and we don't want to overturn this. When they make moral and ethical decisions all the time, and it's not connected to any coherent legal dogma, right? But they get themselves to believe that they are a part of an institution of rules when they're making substantively moral decisions every single day. And it's just, it's cultish in some ways.
Without a doubt. And this has been a big fight in legal circles for 30 or 40 years. The idea of sort of the Brandeisian, I mean, obviously it existed prior to that, but
yeah.
It has been coming up in the form of like critical legal studies versus classical legal thought and the classical Brandeis brief, where you must look at the implications on real world people.
Yeah, yes. Right. Like actually think about the implications of your decision, which like
I never thought we'd be talking about Brandeis outside of my college classes in the Brandeisian thought.
I mean, but this is a really important thing for people to be conscious of, because at the very least, we should not be celebrating people whose actions are subject to the same critique and review as anyone else. There is no, you are not performing last rites for someone as a priest. Like, you know, I can understand it. Okay. You're going to go in and perform last rites, someone who is evil or whatever, right. As a priest.
Or like,
What's going on here.
A surgeon has a responsibility to keep the patient alive, even if they're operating on a murderer or something.
Exactly. Exactly. And the idea that they're this is thrown up as a shield from this type of critique, it is really detrimental to our society. I mean, I know this seems, seemingly off topic for all the things that are going on right now, but this is going to be,
it's going to be on topic once, like, if, you know, assuming Joe Biden does become president.
Yes, I think this is going to be a big deal because, you know, much of what we're going to see as politics over the next couple of years, even if the Democrats take the Senate, because they're going to basically get an opportunity to pass one big reconciliation bill. And that's basically going to be it. And then everything else is going to be on judges and whatnot. But the way that policy gets, the way that policy gets executed and what is taking place in our sort of like adjacent to a government, but is still very much of the fabric of the way that both our politics and our government works, is really important for people to focus on. I can't tell you how much I appreciated that article.
Oh, thank you.
So we just got a couple more minutes and let's talk about this sort of, we're getting, on some level, I could see a parallel. Maybe I just see it everywhere with this this whole thing with like the outrage that 106 Republican lawmakers have signed on to this Ken Paxton lawsuit coming from the Texas AG. Incidentally,
Texas suing the other states' rights Republicans all the way.
Well, and let's be clear. I think everyone knows that on some level, this is Ken Paxton a little bit worried about the federal investigation that's been ongoing that actually crescendoed yesterday when a subpoena, when they had a, they basically subpoenaed his you know, records. But he could be looking for a pardon. But this idea that like people are just like, can you believe democracy is being attacked by these 106 Republican House members? I mean, I think it's a good thing to say, but it's also sort of like, when are we going to accept that the Republican Party is the Republican Party?
Yeah.
And why do we need the Lincoln Project to come out and tell us how upset they are about this thing that they created?
Right. Right. I mean, that's been the tension a lot recently, is like to be like, and I think, you know, for those of us who have been observing the extremism of the American conservatism for a while, you do have to regularly be like, I'm not at all surprised that all of these elected Republican officials are like trying to overturn the election. I'm not surprised, but I still acknowledge that it's very bad for democracy, and it is. It's like a hard, it's like honestly kind of a hard line, because you know, I don't want to be the cynic who's like, oh, you're surprised that they're anti-democratic, because like, you know, it should, I mean, it should be upsetting and it should be shocking.
Well, it's not even a question about like, you know, oh, I can't believe you're not surprised. It should be like, okay, here is evidence number 5,633. How about now you accept the fact that this party is, you know, and this ties in, you know what, let's take a quick break. Cause I want to talk about the audio that came out from Joe Biden this week.
Oh yeah.
And, because it seems to me all part and parcel of this, this same theme. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back in a second. So audio was leaked this week. And, you know, I always get curious as to like how audio leaks, you know, was this on purpose or was it not on purpose? I mean, who knows? Right. But it was a Zoom call with civil rights leaders and Joe Biden. And Joe Biden sort of waded into and wanted to sort of like both say that Democrats were killed by the defund the police thing. There's plenty of data out now that suggests that's absolutely not the case.
Yeah.
Stanley Greenberg had a great piece recently saying that, I'm sorry, that's just not what happened.
Yeah.
But putting that aside, he also then sort of unprompted went into this whole thing about my progressive friends, I don't know who it was he was talking about. My progressive friends want me to do stuff by executive action, and that's against the Constitution. I'm not going to do it. Like that to me is the flip, you know, like the flip side of, first of all, it's not, it's not unconstitutional.
No.
And any more so than, you know, Nancy Pelosi arguing back in the day that, if we impeach Donald Trump, he won't be able to be criminally prosecuted. it's not unconstitutional, but it is, it seems to me part and parcel of the same thing where it's just like, we can work with Republicans.
Yeah. 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 I mean, I don't know. There was that story. It must have been a Bloomberg story because I didn't actually read the whole thing. But it was like, well, you know, they got the paywall. It's a very difficult paywall. But it was like Biden is, you know, he's going to like appoint a basically an ambassador to conservatives or something. Like, I don't know. It was just a very strange, like he's going to have someone in his cabinet whose job is to reach out to conservatives. And, you know, like, I mean, we are at a point. My colleague, Osita Nuevo, wrote this. I think nearly the beginning of the year, like we actually have to talk about how we are going to defeat the Republican Party, not how we are going to.
Yeah.
Like we need to actually talk about how, like, Democrats need to actually think in terms of how are we going to defeat this malignant force that is the modern Republican Party. Not and for far too long, the only way they have thought about politics is how will we operate within a world in which they are dominant. You know, how will we sort of eke out our wins in a world in which Republicans are naturally in charge of things? And they just they actually need to reorient their thinking to, like, obviously they're not governing partners, but like at this point they are a like actual threat to the stability of the country and to the democratic order. And like, we need to actually politically defeat them.
Do you think it's possible for this generation of Democrats to make that turn? I mean, because I am increasingly believing that, like, the problem is, you know, to some extent ideological. I definitely think it's ideological, but I also think it's like so rude. Like, you could pursue their, you could be them, pursue your ideology, and also sort of like exert a little bit more power and partisanship and still pursue your ideology. I mean, but you know, it's almost like they're even like, I don't know, abdicating their own responsibility to carry out their own ideology. Maybe that's an easier way of doing it.
Right.
I mean, I think all those are valid perspectives on it, but you know, I look at this, story about Dianne Feinstein this week.
Yeah.
Where she, you know, they're, you know, former staffers are having to leak, like she needs to be, she doesn't know where she is, essentially, to Jane Mayer and the New Yorker. And I go, like, you know, this is a very clear case of a generational problem.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. And I think that, like, it's definitely, I think it's separate from ideology. I think that, like, just like you said, there is an ideological element to it. I think that there is a part of the sort of moderate democratic worldview that requires a Republican Party to work with in order to beat back the left. I think that that's a given. But like, that requiring a Republican Party to exist that can be worked with, like, stopped working during the Bush years, basically. During the Gingrich years, practically.
Yep.
I think it's like, you have most younger liberals who aren't even that radical, like, have not seen in their lifetime a Republican Party that can be quote unquote worked with. And I think that that's like totally a generational thing.
Definitely. And also, I mean, sorry, we're just seeing this with Whitmer. We talked about this on the show that. And oh, there we go. We are of one mind now, that, you know, you don't even need to be an AOC in terms of your politics to fight Republicans, on the battlefield of politics, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that this, Biden presidency, assuming it actually happens, I think one of the things I think perhaps the real story in terms of the Biden presidency from the perspective of progressives, I mean, once we get past, like, you know, okay, no Donald Trump, great, but in terms of like the dynamic that's going to play out, is there's going to be a lot of these fights and arguments are going to start at day one. In fact, they've already started in a way that they never did under the Obama administration.
I don't remember this much arguing about the cabinet.
Not even close. Yeah. There was not this type of scrutiny on transition. None of it.
Yeah.
That on day one, there is going to be the Biden administration is going to be one where we get a very clear delineation between what these factions of the Democratic that build up the Democratic Party want. We have to say goodbye to our viewers on Peacock. Again, the show plays 5 and 10 p.m. on the Peacock app, the Choice Channel. We will see you folks on Monday. Thanks for joining us. And for the rest of you, specialer people, we will stay here. But, I mean, don't you think that's going to be the case, Alex?
Absolutely,
This is like... I mean, I just remember I was naive during the Bush years. Like, you know, there were people I would have on the radio show or people who were on other shows who we were fighting George Bush tooth and nail on Social Security in 2005, right?
Hmm.
They wanted to privatize Social Security. And there was a real concerted effort. In fact, it came out of Josh Marshall's blog at the time where he used the blog to whip essentially or to get a whip count of and force Congress people to in their districts, Republicans for the most part, where do you stand on privatizing Social Security? And that, you know, became the basis of a big fight that beat back that privatization. And then years later, I'm like talking to some of these people, you know, these, you know, liberals. I guess Jonathan Alter comes to mind, who, guy wrote a book on FDR, Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not, you know, and he is like, we had a conversation at the MSNBC Green Studio, their green room or whatever it was. Like, he's like, I don't understand why, you know, the left is so chaste about, you know, cutting back on some expansion of Social Security. I'm like, what? And, you know, to his credit, he came on the show and we had a debate about it. We had a debate about Medicare. And I think on some level it, I didn't see as much of that from him. I mean, yeah. I think he was, you know, sort of cloistered and, and he did not promote that as much. And then, you know, that line of thinking, and then within the, you know, 3 or 4 years, 5 years from there, maybe it was like three, you have the Senate caucus voting to expand Social Security.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that's related, but I'm saying like that was the point being that there's this clarifying moment, you know, when you come out of a conservative governance where you start to realize that, you know, how aligned you are with people that you were fighting against the administration with. And I think that's like, you know,
that's, yeah. And, you know, I mean, it's like, right. To describe my own sort of naive moment, it felt, you know, 2008 felt a lot like, well, like this new ascendant wing of the Democratic Party has beat back Clintonism, right? And then, I mean, it turned out to be much less of a break than we all thought. But that's also why it felt like that wasn't, you know, that's also why it didn't feel like it was the time for, you know, having these arguments. But that's not, like, this time around, that's not, like, a lot of segments of the Democratic Party coalition did not get their first choice and are well aware they didn't get their first choice. And I think that, like, we're going to see it's going to be more acceptable to have these sort of arguments in public and we're going to have more of them. You know, and who, again, I don't know how productive it will be because so far the Biden administration appears to be really, really stubborn about not giving in, to, like, you know, progressive demands on the cabinet and things like that. There's definitely going to be more arguing about it, this time around than there was in the first Obama term, I think.
All right. Well, Alex Perrine, thanks so much for your time today. Much appreciated.
Of course.
Folks should check out. They should, you know, well, what I always do is I just go to you. I have your page bookmarked.
That's just fine.
Waiting for you to drop your, drop your story. But also folks can check out, The Politics of Everything, which is a weekly show, right?
Bi-weekly.
What does that mean?
Every 2 weeks.
Jeez, man. Really?
We're trying to put out a magazine too.
He's trying to chill, right? I mean,
do a once a quarter podcast.
I would love to, frankly.
No wonder why you got so much time to like set up your,
your
posters.
My home studio, posters.
Yeah. Got a lot of time. All right. Appreciate it.
All right.
Thank you, Alex Perrine. And do we have Matthew Film Guy?
Yes, we do.
Look at that. Matthew Film Guy promoting the Ted Alexandro show. Oh, wait a second. But don't we have something else, Matt? Hold on, Matthew Film Guy. Pretend you're not here.
Yeah, give me 1 second on that. I forgot all about that.
Pandemic head.
I have severe pandemic head today.
Let's do the intro after we do the cold open with Matthew, maybe.
Oh, look at that. Look at that. Matthew Film Guy doing his, he has his Majority Report, what do you call those again? Bandanas.
Yeah, put the glasses over the bandanas so they don't fog.
Yeah.
That's horrible
Matthew
about the
Film
mask.
Guy, let's talk about this. Do you have a problem when you go out with the fogging of the mask?
You're muted.
Yes, most definitely. I struggle, although I bought one that's sort of more form-fitting when I'm really out there in the world. I saved
it. I did too, but it still fogs my glasses no matter what.
I find that if you don't look down, if you make sure you look straight out, that helps. Because looking down, like I'm walking the dogs.
I'm always looking down.
Keep your head up, kid. Come on.
I know. My neck is like bothering me because I'm always just like on my phone or whatever.
Right. You got to hold the phone out like this. Yeah, it's a struggle. I've started to just put contacts in if I know I've got to like go in somewhere and do something.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know,
I've been contemplating doing the contacts thing, but I don't really have any. Like, I'm like, the contacts I have are from like literally like 2012 maybe or something like that. And I'm like, I don't know if I should put these in, but it's a real problem because I'm old and my glasses are progressives. And
everything with you is progressive.
Everything's
progressive.
I don't
really even know what that means, okay, to be honest.
It means that like if I was my age 25 years ago, I would have bifocals.
Right.
But instead, my prescription changes. That's why sometimes I'm like, why is Sam doing this? It's because
I do this.
The prescription here is different than the prescription down here. So if I want to read something in a specific way, I need to shift my glasses. And so the whole thing where you put your glasses over your mask like that and push it in, which my son Saul does, he's got the whole thing down. I can't do that. Because then I can't, like, the focal length is all screwed up.
Yeah.
And I can't see
my eyes. My eyes are going crazy. I can't see, goddammit.
Exactly. This is where Michael would be making fun of me in a big way. But it is a real problem. It is a real problem. And it's even more of a problem in the cold. I mean, when it was, over the summer, I was like, oh, this is not going to be a problem. People talk about glasses fogging up.
But, yeah.
Now it's
and I've bought at least three masks that claim fog proof. It's nonsense. It's nonsense. They're less, but there's nothing. There's no solution. And you I tried the soap on the lenses. Forget it.
Did you try that?
Yeah. It lasts for like, I don't know, 15 minutes.
Soap on the lenses?
Yeah. If you do a thin film, so you don't like completely wipe it off, so it's still clear. But even that is, you know.
That sounds like maybe it shouldn't be by your eyes, but I don't know.
Well, I get dizzy and I pass out, but I can see for like 15 minutes. It's great.
Matthew Film Guy, try bleach.
I've tried that. I've tried applying it directly to the eyes.
Have you tried injecting it?
No, I'm afraid of needles, or otherwise I would.
Okay, so do we have the Matthew Film Guy? I've been vamping for a long time.
Are we on? What is this?
All right, Matthew Film Guy.
I got it right here.
Okay.
Here we go.
Is this Emma's first time here?
Matthew the Film Guy is choosing your streams. Cassavetes on Netflix and other such themes. Maybe you'll watch one and learn a few things. Please recommend me a movie to stream. Matthew, please recommend me a movie to stream. Listen, Matthew, Film Guy.
Emma, is this the first time you've heard that?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
There you go.
Please recommend me a movie to stream.
Yeah. Back this segment started when streaming movies was like a new technology. I mean, 10 years ago, honestly, and
yeah.
It was like, what should I stream? Because I couldn't, because, you know, I went through having a kid. I've had a kid under the age of 7 now for 15 years. And that's a long time. And so I couldn't go out to the movies. Now, of course, I can go to the movies because I'm not with my kids as, you know, as much as I used to because I've created a broken family. And now I can't go to a movie theater.
Well,
just in time for the movies to end completely.
Yes, exactly.
So Matthew, what is as the film guy, what's your take on HBO Max just releasing all those movies at once? Are they releasing them all at one time?
Yeah, all at once. So listen, I am an HBO Max subscriber. So on the one hand, very selfishly, I'm like, oh, I'll definitely stay home and watch those movies. And I was almost definitely probably not going to go see those in the theater myself anyway. But look, I'm a little bit.
I will remind you, it's Matthew Film Guy, not Matthew Movie Guy.
No, but I go both ways. You know that, you know. So listen, it's a little bit of hurrying down the doomsday that was already coming.
Yeah.
And I still am a huge believer in movie theaters. Like as long as like everyone's phones are off, everyone's not talking, everyone's paying attention to the movie, everyone went to the bathroom before the movie started. All right, maybe that's a little going too far, but you know, believe in the theater experience. I just think it's going to actually result in ticket prices going to be more like what you go see at like an iPick or an Alamo Drafthouse, where it's like $20-$25 for a special movie event and you get food and all that stuff. It's going to have to change. So I don't mind not seeing Matrix 4 in person.
Is Dune also coming out on HBO Max?
I didn't hear that one.
I don't know. I saw on the I really wanted to see Dune in theaters. That's the thing maybe I miss most to do in the pandemic is go to the movies.
I mean, honestly, the last movies that I saw were the spectacle ones, you know, the big screen ones that you want to fill your whole peripheral vision and so on. And there's only so close I can sit to my flat screen TV.
There are still psychos that go and like sit in mass in the movie theater. It's just that's not going to be my decision.
Psycho. I'm not going I'm barely going to the grocery store right now, let alone to a movie theater. I'm catching up on a million. They're heating up.
Yeah.
They're heating up. So this is like it's like a great time because there's less to do in terms of like responsibilities in some way. So I can catch up on a lot of movies, but it's also a terrible time to actually go and see a movie in a theater.
Yeah.
Sam.
Well, speaking of movies in a theater, last week you had some news for me that we were going to have you on the show, but it was too late.
It's fine. It's still there.
Yeah. So what do we got? What's the big breaking news story you have for us, Matthew Film Guy?
This just in, the movie that I've been talking about for 12 months straight has finally gotten a release. Black Bear, starring Aubrey Plaza, directed by Lawrence Michael Levine, is out now on all VOD, video on demand streaming platforms.
Send us a trailer to play?
Where's the trailer?
You can just Google it up real quick. Black Bear trailer. It's right there. It's wonderful. That would be wonderful. I'll vamp a little bit while you grab that. It's easy. And actually, it is playing in about a dozen art house theaters right now around the country. Smaller theaters that I guess are being very careful about their social distancing. But one of them is actually the Cedar Lee, which is in Cleveland, which was like the first art house theater I ever went to.
No relation.
No, it's Cedars, C-E-D-A-R.
I just want to make that clear.
Yeah.
Love Aubrey Plaza. I mean, who doesn't?
I don't know.
Sam didn't know who she was.
She's from Parks and Rec, Sam. You watch that show?
No.
Yeah, we've been down this road. Here you go. Check out the trailer, folks.
All right, here's the trailer.
I didn't edit the trailer, but it's genius.
All right, this Matthew Film Guy did not edit the trailer, but he did. Edit the movie. Is that Audrey? What's her face?
Aubrey Plaza, yes. That's her, Sam. And the music is amazing, too. The soundtrack just came out today.
You're Allison?
Yeah. You're Gabe?
Hi, I'm Allison.
Oh, I know. I'm Blair.
You're really pretty.
You are too.
You used to be an actress and now you're a director. Why'd you give it up?
I didn't.
So, do you guys have a plan for this place?
I don't really know what we're doing.
We were living in Brooklyn, and it was getting so expensive, and we weren't really working, so...
I figured if I never learned how to cook, then I would never become a housewife.
You're really hard to read.
Yeah, you know what? I get that all the time.
Do you find it weird acting in your own films?
I actually find it kind of humiliating.
Roll sound.
Mark.
Okay, whenever you're ready.
Action.
You don't think she knows what I'm up to? She's oversimplifying a lot.
It's just so rare to pick a real artist's brain. How can you make something if you don't have anything to say?
I have something to say. I just think the movie is the only way to say it.
It's like she can't stand the fact that I have a single thought about this world.
No, it's that I can't stand the thoughts about the world that you have.
This has been so fun.
You don't love me anymore.
Leave me alone!
Now I'm wondering what kind of mind games you're playing with me.
He's my husband, okay?
Claire, calm down a little bit?
Me?
I've been lying since the second I got here.
You're in love with her, you are, I know it.
This is what you
you wanted, okay? This is going to ruin us!
Okay, cut. I just want to be normal people again.
Wow.
So you did the editing for that?
I edited the film, yes. Thank you.
It looks amazing. Like, it looks very unique. I'm pumped. That's amazing. Congrats.
I get the sense that, like, we're seeing both clips from the movie within the movie and the reality. That's what's, and it's one of those jobbies, isn't it? What's real?
It's one of those jobbies, yes.
Is it like a Tropic Thunder thing where they don't, well, you can't tell, where they don't know they're actually in
she's
a movie?
She's the dude playing the dude disguised as the other dude, you mean?
Also, I love Christopher Abbott. Great actor, too.
My sister has just texted me. She said, this popped up. I've listened to at least three shows in which Aubrey Plaza comes up and you don't know who she is and everyone tells you who she is. You know, I've got so much to remember. Like, why would I remember that?
No, I know. It's almost like you're making a deliberate effort at this point not to know because you've been told so
many times.
No, I'm
not.
But you're in like the comedy space. She's in, you know, sort of.
She was gone by the time she was ascendant.
Oh my God. You know? Are you kidding? When I was in the comedy space, she was probably like in elementary school.
Well, I mean, I don't know. You know people now still. She's kind of big. I don't know.
Sam, when I did Bad Situationist and you cast me in there and I was acting a little bit, I'm like, oh, well, maybe I should take an improv class. I went and took an improv class with Amando Diaz, and she was in that class. She was like 19 years old.
Oh, really?
And even at that time, my first ever improv class, at that time, it was clear she was going to be something special. She was amazing. And a lot of people didn't necessarily know that she had these kinds of dramatic acting chops. This movie is also very funny in a lot of places, but it is a tour de force. You know, a lot of the references we had were like Gina Rollins, Woman Under the Influence, Opening Night, these kinds of things. So there is I would just say, without giving too many spoilers, because part of the fun is the sort of funhouse Hall of Mirrors structure.
I get that sense, yes.
But it is...
you don't know when you're in the movie and when you're not in the movie.
Just nod and smile. Yes.
Okay.
She was dramatically really good in that movie, Ingrid Goes West, too. That's another little indie one where she's good.
Yeah, I keep hearing about that, and I definitely have that on my list. You know,
did she remember you from that improv class?
I don't think she remembered me, but she certainly remembered the class. And actually, when we got met on set, because I actually was up there on set when this was happening, which is rare for an editor, but I reminded her.
Is it that rare these days?
It's becoming more
because you can actually
thing.
Like download and input. Like, what did you shoot that on?
Digital, obviously, high definition, an Arri 2K camera. Yeah.
And so you can actually input that and log it and begin to do cuts so that you get a notion of like what you need to go back and do pickups, right?
That's precisely what I did, Sam. Exactly right. We were able to do reshoots in the last 3 days while we were there based on things that I had cut while we were there. But when I said to her, do you remember that class? She's like, oh, yeah, you look familiar. So at least she was nice enough to lie to me that way. But actually, she's such a cool person. We've been sharing pictures on Instagram. People can go to my Instagram at Langdon Boom and see some behind the scenes pictures and stuff. And she's been sharing some of the pictures I took.
Has she bought anything from your eBay store?
No, I've really got to work our way up. We don't have that kind of relationship yet, but you know, eventually I'm sure she will. But you know, like maybe this, if I don't really ruin it. But anyway, she's amazing in this movie. Like you said, Chris Abbott is amazing. Sarah Gadon, also just three genius actors. And Larry Levine, who wrote this, he's also an actor, and it just understands it's an actor's movie, despite having this really kind of brain teaser structure.
Some Z for Zachariah vibes, which is also I don't know if you saw that movie, but that's
It's
a three person kind of claustrophobic movie. Hey, I'm not lying. I watch a lot of movies.
That's great. Well, Emma, I can't wait for you to see this. I can't wait for other people to see it. It's been getting great reviews, 88% on Rotten Tomatoes for a weird art house movie. I think that's
thrilling. Pretty good, man.
And people are really digging in. Like if you go on Letterboxd, people can also follow me on Letterboxd at Langdon Boom. I'm Matthew Film Guy on there. And just, you know, the kind of just theorizing and insights, and it's, you know, it's ambiguous, so it can hold sort of different interpretations, but it's just, you know, it's also in its DNA as like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, like the sort of like, you know, dinner party gone bad kind of vibe. That's part of it too. So it's really great seeing people.
I have to say, you know, sometimes it's difficult in trailers to pick up on this, but the acting does look exceptional.
Yeah. And listen, I'll put it to you this way. Everybody knows that the editor is the unsung hero when it comes to making a movie. People who know films.
And so, now that you're tooting your own horn, you're the sung hero.
That's right. I will. This is time to be sung. Let that which is unsung be sung.
I don't think I've ever seen you so like sort of effervescent.
Oh, this has been the best week ever. I mean, on the one hand, the pandemic being what it is has robbed me of, like, you know, some red carpet events and parties and all that kind of hobnobbing stuff. But what it's done is it's meant that this is one of the few movies that people are actually able to see right now, new movies. And all it's just been really fun seeing.
That's the right. Massive this must have been just reaction. Like right in under the wire, right?
Yeah, we finished in August and we made it into Sundance in January. And that was the last film festival. You know, literally we left Sundance thinking, like, did we get a disease there? Like, it was like, that was right as things were starting. In fact, one of the other actors who's a writer in the movie, we kept thinking, like, we should pitch, like, Outbreak at a film festival as a film. So maybe the time has passed for that. But it was one of the last ones to happen. And so it got bought and now it's on demand and sort of a captive audience.
Well, I was about to shift to what your movie recommendation is for this week. But I'm going to say that obviously the first thing that people should watch is Black Bear. And I can't imagine
anybody. Z for Zachariah, definitely.
Seen it yet. What?
No. Z for Zachariah. That's what I'm going to watch. I've seen Black Bear. So
Z for Zachariah is Margot Robbie, Chris Pine, and Chiwetel Ejiofor. And it's a three-person kind of like locked in a situation drama, which is why I said.
Okay, I love that. You know, Larry, the director of this movie, and I met in a class taught by actor, writer, director Tom Noonan.
Oh my gosh, so much of your career is centered around Noonan, hasn't it?
Literally. Well, it goes back to the genesis of Ray Carney. Ray Carney introduced me to you. He introduced me to Tom. And then Tom, we met Larry there. And now Larry and I have worked together a bunch of times. This is the first feature film of his that I've edited. But Tom's two movies, What Happened Was and The Wife, also both one location, interacting people, sort of, again, the DNA of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. And so, you know, that's.
And this is exciting. Like, I don't want to participate into, like, you know, you know, my perspective on show business is very much about managing expectations. But,
absolutely.
I mean,
please,
a director shoots a feature film. It does well. That usually leads to maybe a second chance at another feature film. If you are the editor, I know that from my perspective, it's like I got locked in to key people who worked with me that, you know, you develop these relationships. It works. You like their work and it becomes more of a collaboration as you move through. So, I mean, this is like, this could be the ticket to ride.
Well, listen, Larry and I, this is Larry's third film, and he and his wife, Sophia, have made films together where he's written it and she's directed it. So they've made like five or six movies together, and I edited the trailers for most of those movies. And Larry,
who did the editing
friends.
For those other movies? Why didn't Larry use you in the before?
Just a variety of circumstances, different things, and, you know.
Well, I hope he's learned his lesson. I mean, this is his most successful movie, isn't it?
I'd say so, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah, I would definitely say so.
I'm pumped because the editing
looks different
snappy.
Here? What's different
and
with this
cool.
equation? It's because you edited it.
Okay. I won't take that away from you, Sam, if that's your insight you want to share. But listen, Larry and I had such a good time making this movie, and we're just friends. So it's really fun to have a friend who you really respect. And honestly, he asked me to edit this movie and he sent me the script and I was ready to say yes before I read it. And after I read the script, I was so blown away, but I was also like relieved because I'm like, oh my God, this is going to be a really good movie. Right. You know, like, thankfully this is going to be good. And the script is amazing and it accounts for most of what's great about the movie. But listen, I'll toot my own horn a little bit. It was a wild shoot, the circumstances of the shoot, indie film, never enough time. We were out in the remote woods. You know, Mary, you know, my fiance Mary was in this movie. She has a role as one of the crew members on the film within a film crew. And oh my God, the nightmare scenarios that they had to be put through. locked.
Oh, tell
in the
us some stories of that. I love production stories. You know that my share of.
You know what it's like, Sam. And a lot of what's great about the film within a film is the truth.
How many days
about,
was the shoot?
It was like 20 days.
Wow.
Yeah.
And all the locations are up there, though, right?
Yeah, it was one location, basically. But it was an hour drive from any civilization to get to this cabin. The cabin didn't have its own power grid, so they kept having blackouts during the show.
Oh, what so location? I mean, if it was my shoot, we would all be living at the cabin.
Some people were living at the cabin, but the three big names needed a little bit nicer accommodations.
I understand. Yes.
But Mary and I were living in this, like, it was basically like the visitor's cabin in this, like, it was like this bungalow colony that there were two of them next to each other that we all stayed in. And listen, my cabin was the highest internet service there. And it was like a 1 megabit DSL. So it was like very rustic.
Okay.
And so yeah, long hours, schedule changes. One of the actresses had to go to the hospital. She actually got sick. Paola Lazzaro, who's actually now in Walking Dead. She's on Walking Dead after this.
Of course, Paola Lazzaro.
Yeah. Yeah. You like Walking Dead.
I do.
She's the new girl. She's Princess, you know, with the big machine gun. No, you didn't watch.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I do know. I do know.
Yeah, she's wearing the pink thing.
Yeah, yeah. She's a little bit touched, right? She's a little bit. Yes. She's been isolated too long.
Yes,
yeah.
It was typecasting for her. But anyway, hey, Paola. If it's, an indie film, you know you're going to have more things to do than time to do it in. Actor schedules. Was it something I said?
Yeah, she didn't want to hear that.
Yeah, but yeah, it was one of those movies that just like, oh my God, it's a miracle when any movie comes out. And then
what
when
was
it comes
the shooting
out
ratio?
This good.
I know. It's a little inside.
I didn't keep 4-1, 3-1. I mean,
4-1, 3-1. That's a little tight for video, right?
Well, you know, it's some scenes there were 16 takes and some scenes we only had 2 takes, you know, but actually since this movie is very actor based, it was a lot of long takes that were intercut. So they would roll for like 10 or 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And, which is part of what was great about being
improv or very stuck to
the script. Very stuck to the script. Despite Aubrey Plaza being a genius level improviser, it was, I'd say, 90%.
And does your director do like a lot of rehearsals beforehand, or is it just show
up? He had the time. They had no time. It was like, okay, here it is. Yeah, they had script meetings and you're on set. And listen, a lot of the first takes were not usable because they're working out the camera positions. They're working things out. It was all seat of the pants stuff, which as an editor makes it more fun because you're not just putting tab A into slot B and just piecing it together. You're actually able to build it.
Having to create stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was,
and did you do stuff like so L cuts?
Of course, Sam. Of course. You do L cuts. You do insert edits. You do everything.
What other podcast? What other political podcast exists where you're going to get like funny, like sarcastic, ironic, film editing jokes like that? Did you do any L cuts?
Pacman's going to have me on to do a segment, but
Pacman's not going to come up with that.
No, definitely.
You know, nobody's going to come up with that joke.
No,
of course you did L cuts, folks. You can't do a major motion picture without doing an L cut.
No.
My God.
We do pre-lapse, we do L cuts, we do everything around
What editing technology are you using these days? What did you use for that?
Adobe Premiere.
No more Cut Pro for people, right? That's out 10 years ago.
Moved on. Yeah. And actually at Sundance, I got interviewed by the Adobe Premiere people. They were thrilled that such a great movie was done on their product. And for some promotional consideration, I had a little video made. You can find that online somewhere.
Thank you, Adobe. Promotional consideration. They paid you?
Well, they gave me free use of their software for a year, which is like for an editor, that's ching.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
I mean, well, I would have done it anyway, but you know, they were very nice.
I got to tell you, I am so excited for you. I don't think I have ever. the whole show is just like everybody's like, oh, I'm going to get lunch. I'll be right back.
It's fine. I'm just here to talk to you. Well, hi, Emma.
I'm back.
How was lunch? Matt took off.
I usually use the restroom when we have the fun half break, but had to Had to leave at some point. Sorry.
That's okay. We're still, this is a part of Emma's training. This is like 90% of this is just bladder control.
Right. Yeah. Right.
This type of show.
That separates the pros from the amateurs.
Right. Indeed. I'm not there yet in my conditioning.
I've trained myself to urinate only once a week. And so I do that.
That's why you're looking a little sallow.
Honestly, I couldn't be happier. I actually think that I'm going to watch this movie tonight.
Sam, do it. If there's never been a movie I've recommended that you watch, watch this one.
I'm definitely going to watch it.
I'm very excited about this.
And Matt needs to know, if Matt's not listening, Matt, there's some pot humor in this movie. So there's something for everybody. So Matt should really make note of that as well.
I also like pot humor. I've never tried.
Yeah, I already got you on the hook. Matt was walking away, so I had to.
Matthew, what about me? Why will I like it?
You like it just because you like intelligent cinema of the highest caliber. So
it does look really good in terms of meta cinema. Yeah,
it's great, and you know it's not for everybody. It's been polarizing. You know, I've been laughing at some of the sort of normie reviews on Internet Movie Database, but it just goes to show you that you know you're seeing a movie that's taking chances, that's doing something, if not completely original, very, very risky to do to an audience, especially when used to the star quality of Aubrey Plaza. I feel like that's mostly the people who are like, this is not Parks and Rec. You know, this isn't.
Yeah.
But it's a movie for people who like movies, you know, who are really into digging in and wondering what's going on and, you know, comfortable with ambiguity. Most of the movies that I show in my class, by the way, let's hype the class for a second. You can go online on my Twitter and sign up.
I want to tell you the text from my other sister. Don't forget to tell Matthew Film Guy that Mom and I loved his class. He is really great teaching the class. Great with the entis.
yes. Well, thank I got to tell you, Matthew,
I'm very excited about this. This is one of the few films that that you know I get the sense of like, oh, this is going to make me angry about not doing any more films, which rarely happens to me these days. I mean, mostly because Saul makes me watch horrible Avenger movies and like
Jim
that stuff.
Carrey and the Avengers.
Like the Avenger stuff is.
Oh, but by the way, Sam, I heard you say the other day you didn't want to watch Thor. You've got to watch Thor Ragnarok. That's definitely the best of all the Marvel movies.
I saw Thor Ragnarok. It was funny.
Is this all going to involve I like Black Panther best. Like that? I'm sorry. That's just the whole portal
it
opening
has the
up
Hulk.
And like, huh?
But it's Taika Waititi, right? The New Zealand comedian director. He directed that. So it was Marvel giving their huge franchise to this sort of comedian, you know, Flight of the Conchords type humor. So
and,
to see what that is like, you should see that, if nothing else.
What's it called? The movie that Jojo Rabbit was lovely. That movie he directed.
That's still on my list.
Somebody recommended I watch that with Milo. But I to get to Thor 3, I got to do Thor 1 and 2. And I just really, honestly.
No, forget it. Forget Thor 1 and 2. Just go right. I think it's
Sam,
2.
I didn't
tell
see
that
Thor
to my,
1 and 2.
My near OCD kid who's like, wait, no, we're not going to 3. We're going to 1.
I love him.
Two,
oh, this is good.
3. That's the way it works, Dad.
Well, if you can't submit to a rigorous viewing of the Avengers movies in order, then what are you even doing, Sam?
I mean, I said, please, let's just watch Batman. Batman is good. He's like, no, no. After the Captain America, we're going to watch Iron Man 1, 2, and 3. Then we're going to watch The Hulk. Then we're going to watch all three of the Thor movies. And
I love him. He's a kid after my own heart.
I'm not going to do that.
And, maybe you can learn a thing or two from your son about being rigorous and, you know, being intelligent and consuming.
Is he into Star Wars yet?
Oh, we watched every single one of the Star Wars.
Did he like the prequels? Because, like, I grew up with those, but they're actually objectively horrible now that I'm an adult.
You know,
they were horrible.
He had a critique.
I know, but I thought they were cool then, right?
Yeah.
He had a critique. He has a good critique of this stuff. And I can tell you just like, it's like how much Lego building is going on during a movie. And then like I say, like, dude, how can you say these Avenger movies are good? You built, look at you built during this. And he's like, well, I like to do both same time.
And I'm like, you're not with movies that you like.
Genius.
All right, well, Matthew Film Guy.
I feel like this spot is going to be Saul Film Guy is not right around the corner for this segment,
Just a matter of time. Yeah. Again, congratulations. Folks can go to all of your different pages and follow you at Langdon
Prime Boom. Video, Apple TV, Fandango Now, Spectrum. All your cable companies have it. Video on demand. Please rent or buy it today.
And then don't hesitate to go on Twitter and give Matthew kudos. Matthew Film Guy, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Emma. Have a good day, guys.
You too.
Folks, it is that time where we're going to move into the fun half of the program. First off, special episode of the Nomiki show today. Nomiki. God, I don't know what happened. I lost it. Nomiki. on the Nomiki show, not only will Astra Taylor be on, we've had her on to talk about You're Going to Miss Democracy When It's Gone or something to that effect. I can't remember the name of her book. Hattis Thayer is on, and Jamie Peck of the Antifada.
Wow.
And the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be on the Nomi Key Show. You can check that out at youtube.com/the Nomi Key Show right after this one, 3 p.m. You will see Jamie on there. She'll be talking about the Antifada. Matt, what happened last night on Left Reckoning?
Last night we got really deep into this Tyson betting on employees getting COVID thing and talked about Tyson's history of just being a massively, horrifically abusive company. And we also updated on the Argentine millionaires tax, which is a nice development down in South America, and a few other stories. So check that out at Left Reckoning YouTube page. And actually, right after this show, I'm going to be stealing the raid and doing a quick stream on Twitch Left Reckoning, where we're listening to Marx's The Gotha Program, a critique of The Gotha Program. So it's going to be a quick 45-minute stream right after this.
Folks, a reminder, your support makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only support the free show, you get extra content virtually every single day. Yes, it's true. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And don't forget to check out AM Quickie, amquickie.com, 7 minutes of headlines every morning. Before you wake up, it's even there for some of you anyways. lastly, don't forget shop.majorityreportradio.com. You can get merch there. All right, folks. See you in the fun half.
RM for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost as what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a man.
And the alpha males are back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danner's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck. Fuck. Reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?
Hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black. African. The alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
See Donald Trump out there? Doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Cannot hustle.
Come on. Fuck them. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday.
My birthday.
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black.
Come on.
Someone needs to pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.